There are two sessions today. One, the first one involves Chapman and Cloke. That's the former legal director, corporate affairs, as it were, and personnel director. And the critical question for them are the Harbottle and Lewis emails. These were the Harbottle and Lewis report, which said that the company that they had found no evidence to support Clive Goodman, the former Royal Reporter's unfair dismissal claim, that phone hacking was widespread and that other people in the editorial chain knew what he was doing. They'd looked at these emails and came to the conclusion that there was no evidence to support that, and they said there was no evidence of, quote, similar criminal activity. This advice from them was relied upon by the Murdochs and by the company as, if you like, a sort of evidence of a clean bill of health.
And they say it wasn't that broad in its intention. It was a very specific thing on the dismissal case.
That's exactly right. Not only that, these emails appear to be part of, at least, emails subsequently seen by Sir Ken MacDonald, former DPP, again on behalf of News International, who said it took him about 5 seconds flat to realise that these emails evidenced widespread criminal activity. Now, it's probable that what it evidenced was evidence of policemen being paid, in other words, of corruption, not of phone hacking. Hmm. But nevertheless, this is dancing on pinheads. And so Chapman and Cloke are going to have to explain how they constructed the pinhead upon which the company appears to have tried to dance.
And the other issue is the evidence on which they decided to settle the case against Gordon Taylor of the Professional Footballers Association. And the accusation is that email was so damaging that they said, we can't win this case, we're going to settle it. And the issue is, did James Murdoch know why he had to pay out, well, we don't know, but up to £1 million or not?
I think underlying this, the basic facts are not in some respects in dispute here. The evidence had emerged in the course of the Taylor case, which led the company to led their lawyers to the conclusion, because it plainly demonstrated that the company had been involved in hacking Taylor's phone, which, by the way, incidentally involved News of the World staff other than Goodman and Mulcair, other than Goodman, the Royal editor, the significance of which is that the company's position throughout had been it was only one Royal reporter, the rogue reporter as you describe it. So this is pretty damning. Now, the really fruity question here, I suppose you might say, is whether James Murdoch knew or not. Now, in some respects, when he was in front of the committee last month, or in July rather, he said that he was unaware of this email. Subsequently, within 24 hours, Tom Crone, the legal director, and Colin Myler, the former editor, who are both up in front of the committee today, had said he must be mistaken. That's subsequently been investigated with an exchange of letters. But essentially, James Murdoch is in a very hard position here. He's either a knave or a fool. But and on the face of it, there really is no third way.
And he'll probably be called again, won't he?
I'd be very surprised if he isn't.
The World at One. This is Sean Lay with 30 minutes of news and comment. The former legal manager for News International, Tom Crone, has told MPs investigating phone hacking at the News of the World that he did tell James Murdoch about an email suggesting more than one reporter at the newspaper was involved.
The conversation lasted for quite a short period, I would think probably less than 15 minutes or about 15 minutes. It was discussed.
Mr. Murdoch had previously told MPs he was unaware of the email. We'll be examining what this new twist means for him.
Four former executives at News International have been facing a second round of questions from MPs on the Culture, Media and Sport Committee, who are examining phone hacking at the News of the World. A former senior lawyer at the company, Tom Crone, insisted that their boss, James Murdoch, was told in 2008 of an email suggesting hacking went beyond one rogue reporter. Here's our political correspondent, Ben Gagan.
James Murdoch told a previous hearing of the committee that he hadn't been aware of the email, which contained transcripts of voicemails left on the phone of the football executive Gordon Taylor. But today Mr. Crone insisted that email was the reason News International wanted to reach an out-of-court settlement with Mr. Taylor. He told MPs that Mr. Murdoch had to authorise the settlement, and so the email would certainly have been discussed with him. The committee have been trying to explore some of the inconsistencies in what they've been told during their investigation into phone hacking, and it is likely they will ask James Murdoch to reappear before them at a future date. MPs have also heard from Jonathan Chapman, a former human resources manager at News International. He denied accusations that the company had paid over £200,000 to the News of the World's former royal editor as part of a cover-up.
Lord Justice Leveson, who'll chair the judicial inquiry into phone hacking, has said he hopes to produce a report within a year. His officials have published a list of names and organisations that have asked to be legally represented at the hearings. They include the Metropolitan Police, the former chief executive of News International, Rebecca Brooks, and alleged victims of hacking, such as Kate and Jerry McCann and Max Mosley.
Did James Murdoch mislead a committee of MPs investigating allegations of phone hacking at the News of the World? Two claims have been made by witnesses appearing before the Culture Select Committee. A former executive at News International, the paper's parent company, says Mr. Murdoch did not have his facts right when he blamed an outside law firm for not spotting the extent of phone hacking. More seriously, two of his ex-colleagues, the paper's former editor Colin Myler and the ex-legal director Tom Crone, say they did make him aware of the existence of an email which implied that the practice had been used by more than one reporter. In the summer, James Murdoch was asked by the committee whether he had seen or had been made aware of that email.
When you signed off the Taylor payment, did you see or were you made aware of the full Neville email, the transcript of the hacked voicemail message?
No, I was not aware of that at the time.
Well, our political correspondent Gary O'Donoghue has been listening to today's proceedings at the committee and he joins us now from Westminster. Gary.
Yes, it wasn't quite Groundhog Day, but the Culture, Media and Supports and Sports Select Committee was trying to once again to make the differing accounts of News International senior management stack up. One key part of this story is what's called the Ford Neville email, a document that emerged when the head of the Professional Footballers Association, Gordon Taylor, was suing the News of the World over his phone being hacked. That document blew a hole in the company's previous assertions that only one reporter, the Royal Editor Clive Goodman, had been involved in hacking and he'd gone to prison. The committee chairman, John Whittingdale, asked the company's former legal director, Tom Crone, and the former editor of the News of the World, Colin Myler, whether they had told James Murdoch about that email back in 2008.
Can I first of all establish that both of you are certain in your mind that you told James Murdoch about that email when you came to discuss the terms of the settlement with Gordon Taylor?
I'm certain.
You're certain?
He's told about it. It wasn't. It was never referred to as a phone never email. That's quite significant, I think.
And me too. I'm as certain as I can be, yes.
That settlement with Gordon Taylor had cost the company £600,000, way beyond any settlement in a British court over breach of privacy. The Labour MP Tom Watson, a man who's made the phone hacking inquiry practically his life, was convinced that the high level paid to Taylor was to buy his silence. He pressed Tom Crone on the issue.
Was it right to pay him even when he was in prison, when he'd been found guilty by a court?
Pay what?
Paying his salary in prison.
Oh, I have nothing to... I have nothing to do with whether, how his salary was paid. I didn't even know it was being paid.
Okay. And all this despite gross misconduct, hacking into the voicemails of the royal family. It was right to pay him then?
Pay him a salary?
Was it right to pay him the £240,000 payoff?
Well, I have nothing to do with employment.
What do you think about that? What's your view of that?
My views are irrelevant, Mr. Wilson.
The truth is, you didn't see it as gross misconduct, did you? You just thought it was a reporter's job at News of the World.
That is absolute nonsense.
And as far as you're concerned, the only problem was he got caught.
That is nonsense.
And so now you had to conceal the crime.
That is nonsense.
You were desperate to ensure that it didn't become known that hacking was standard practice at News of the World, weren't you?
That's not true.
And that's why you told Goodman that he could have his job back, that if he did not implicate the paper or any of its staff.
Mr. Watson, since... confidentiality in these legal discussions seems to have been waived by Farrers, at least. It may be that if you ask the other lawyers who were present during the legal meetings, they will tell you that the allegation you just made and was originally made by Clive Goodman has no truth at all.
So despite going to jail, Clive Goodman ended up with £250,000 from the company. Philip Davis, the Tory MP, wanted to know why the figure was so high when an employment tribunal could only have awarded Mr. Goodman a maximum of £60,000 following his dismissal by the paper.
If you'd made the right decision and there was absolutely no basis for Clive Goodman's allegations, what on earth were you doing paying him a further £140,000 on top of the £90,000 he'd already been given as a year's salary. How on earth could you justify that?
May I answer that, Mr. Davis?
Please do.
We didn't take the decision. The decision was taken by Mr. Hinton that it should be settled. Following our work on it and recommendation, having been told to try to get a reasonable settlement figure. The position is that, that it was a stark choice. Settle at a reasonable figure or end up in tribunal. The tribunal proceedings would have been several months down the line. At the tribunal proceedings, Mr. Goodman would have been able to make a number of allegations, which we didn't believe, having done our exercise, had any foundation, but he would have been able to make those allegations in a public forum.
In fact, not only had Mr. Goodman been paid nearly a quarter of £1 million, but he'd been promised his job back, according to a letter he wrote to the head of the company's HR department after being released from prison in 2007. The legal director, Tom Grone, confirmed that Andy Coulson, editor at the time that the Royal phones were hacked, and later David Cameron's director of communications, had made that promise to Clive Goodman.
Given it was so significant then, clearly it must have featured pretty large in your conversation with James Murdoch.
Listen, it was the reason that we had to settle the case, and in order to settle the case we had to explain the case to Mr. Murdoch and get his authority to settle. So certainly it would certainly have been discussed. I cannot remember the detail of the conversation, and there isn't a note of it. The conversation lasted for quite a short period, I would think probably less than 15 minutes or about 15 minutes. It was discussed, but exactly what was said, I cannot recall.
So, the contradictions remain. James Murdoch maintains he didn't know about the widespread nature of the hacking, despite senior figures saying that they told him back in 2008. Sean.
Gary O'Donoghue at Westminster. Well, our reporter John Minnell has been following the phone hacking allegations for more than a year now, breaking a number of stories himself along the way. John, why is this email, what we heard referred to a little earlier in the programme as the Forneville email, occupying so much of the committee's attention?
Well, this email contained a transcript of voicemail messages, messages left on the phone of the chief executive of the Professional Football Association, Gordon Taylor, and messages left by Mr. Taylor on somebody else's phone. And this transcript was written by a journalist at the News of the World, and because it said "For Neville" on it, it's claimed it was likely to have been for the attention of the paper's chief reporter, whose first name happened to be Neville. And it is significant because the allegation has been that this is evidence that it wasn't only Clive Goodman, the reporter who ended up going to prison, who was aware of phone hacking at the paper.
Otherwise, others, presumably it would have said for Clive on it.
Absolutely. The allegation is that others clearly, at the very least, knew about phone hacking. And it matters a great deal whether or not James Murdoch knew about this all the way back in 2008, because the company has always claimed until January of this year it was just one rogue reporter.
How likely is it now that in the light of this morning's hearing, other witnesses, including, of course, James Murdoch himself, will be recalled?
Well, as Gary said, we're in a position now where Mr. Murdoch claims he wasn't told about the email when he met Tom Crone and Colin Myler. Mr. Crone and Mr. Myler claim they did tell him. Both sides just can't be right. So it is more likely now, I think, that he will be recalled. The difficulty is, though, that if James Murdoch continues to deny knowledge of this, it's difficult to know how much further MPs can take it. I think it's also possible that Les Hinton, who was another very senior figure at the company at the time, may be called for further questioning, because a couple of witnesses said this morning when they were asked questions, well, that's a question for Mr. Hinton. And again, it's possible, not certain, possible that Andy Coulson may be called to answer questions, because it was suggested that he was keen to give Mr. Goodman his job back after he had served his sentence. MPs might decide, though, that they can't speak to him because of the ongoing police investigation.
John Minnell, thanks very much. Well, the email was evidence used, as we've heard, in the case of Gordon Taylor of the Professional Footballers Association, in the case he was pursuing against the News of the World. Mark Lewis was his lawyer. He's on the line now. Mr. Lewis, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I appreciate you probably didn't hear the twists and turns of this evidence, but you'll be aware, as a result, I guess, of hearing this programme just a few minutes, that Tom Crone has now once again contradicted James Murdoch's claim that he knew nothing about this email. I wonder what you think the implications are of that.
Well, I think it's inevitable that James Murdoch will have to be recalled. There's a direct conflict of evidence. One might look at what James Murdoch said at the last time he gave evidence, saying that he was advised by outside counsel. The maths doesn't really add up, because he said the payments to Taylor plus the legal costs if it went to trial would be about the same amount as if he settled there and then for a cheque. Now, that obviously has to be put to James Murdoch, but it also has to be put to James Murdoch that Tom Crone is definitely saying that information was given to James Murdoch that James Murdoch says he didn't get.
Mr. Crone also said that one of the reasons he hadn't shown the email itself to James Murdoch was that he'd been required to sign a promise not to make copies of that for Neville email or to disclose it widely. And he says that Gordon Taylor's lawyers, by whom I assume he means you and your colleagues, were very, very sensitive about the contents of it. So in a sense, he's putting part of the blame onto you.
I think that's an incredible thing, because the site, on one side, he's saying that he showed it to James Murdoch prior to settlement.
No, he's saying he didn't show it. In fact, he's saying that he made him aware of the contents of it.
Well it's a very difficult thing for him to put forward, to say that wasn't information that was given. But it doesn't matter in so many respects as to what the email might or might not have said. I mean, it wasn't based on a true story. What it showed was that there was somebody called Neville who was handed a transcript of a recorded telephone conversation. You would have thought that would have been something that would have come out in any summary prepared by Tom Crane.
Mark Lewis, thanks very much. Well, the dispute over who knew what is potentially awkward for James Murdoch in his other role as chairman of BSkyB. The company's annual general meeting takes place later this year, potentially the moment at which his chairmanship of that organisation could be challenged. Alan McDougall is managing director of PIRC, a consultancy with pension funds, banks and other investors among its clients, which advises them on corporate governance. Alan McDougall, how awkward do you think this latest turn of events is for James Murdoch in the light of that other role he performs at BSkyB?
Well, I think investors on both sides of the Atlantic are still without a resolution of the problems of reputational risk. I mean, for News International and News Corp, I think that the impact on the business strategy of the company is now being felt. We saw recently that a major contract from New York City was not carried through as a result of reputational risk. On this side of the Atlantic, I think share owners in BSkyB must be worried more now, given today's events, than they have been about what impact this will have on the reputation of BSkyB and its ability to conduct its business effectively. So I think there's real risk here.
Is it possible for them to challenge formally his continuing in that role?
Well, shareholders, we understand from the company, will get a vote on James Murdoch's continuation on the board, as the company is proposing that all its directors should be up for annual election at the annual meeting. We haven't got a date for the meeting yet, but assuming that the company follows through on that, then shareholders will take a view. And I'm afraid at the moment, city sentiment looks to be hardening against his continuing on the board. Whether that's a permanent change or whether it's a temporary change to get over the current problems, I'm not sure.
Alan McDougall of PIRC, thank you.
MPs hear claims that James Murdoch had been warned about the scale of phone hacking at the News of the World, amid denials of a cover-up after the paper's royal correspondent was jailed.
As far as you're concerned, the only problem was he got caught.
That is nonsense.
And so now you had to conceal the crime.
That is nonsense.
You were desperate to ensure that it didn't become known that hacking was standard practice at News of the World, weren't
That's
you?
That's not true.
We'll have full coverage and analysis of the evidence heard today.
James Murdoch has insisted he stands by his evidence to MPs investigating the News of the World phone hacking scandal. A former legal manager at the paper, Tom Crone, told the Media Select Committee today that Mr. Murdoch, News International's then chief executive, was told about an email which suggested hacking was more widespread than previously admitted. Mr. Murdoch maintains he wasn't told. Here's our political correspondent, Ben Gagan.
Today's hearing was called to try to iron out some of the inconsistencies in the evidence given to the committee so far. In August, James Murdoch told MPs that he hadn't been shown an email containing the transcripts of voicemails left on the phone of the football executive Gordon Taylor. It suggested more people were involved in phone hacking at the News of the World than just the former royal editor, Clive Goodman. Mr. Crone told the MPs the email was the reason News International wanted to reach an out-of-court settlement with Mr. Taylor, and that it was discussed during a 15-minute meeting with Mr. Murdoch. But James Murdoch has described today's evidence as unclear and contradictory.
A fresh round of questioning then from MPs over the phone hacking scandal. Today's session of the Culture, Media and Sport Committee quizzed four former News International employees. A key question: James Murdoch says he was not made aware that phone hacking went beyond one rogue reporter. Two of his former employees say that he was. So who's right? Our political correspondent Gary O'Donoghue was listening to the session and joins us from Westminster now. Gary.
Carolyn, thanks. At the centre of the whole phone hacking saga is who knew what when. James Murdoch, son of the News Corp tycoon Rupert, says he was not shown or told of any evidence back in 2008 that the phone hacking saga went beyond the activities of one rogue reporter, Clive Goodman, who'd gone to jail for listening to the voice messages of royal family employees. But two men disagree. Both Tom Crone, the former legal director of the News of the World, and Colin Myler, its editor until the paper closed in July, say they told Mr. Murdoch about an email which made it clear that others in the organisation knew about the practice. It's been dubbed the Four Neville email, referring to the paper's chief reporter, Neville Thirlbeck, and it contained transcripts of voice messages to and from the head of the Professional Footballers Association, Gordon Taylor. He was paid £600,000 by the paper in 2008 to settle his claim. The chair of the Culture Committee, John Whittingdale, wanted to know from Mr. Crone whether James Murdoch definitely knew about that email.
It was the reason that we had to settle the case, and in order to settle the case, we had to explain the case to Mr. Murdoch and get his authority to settle. So certainly it would have been discussed. I cannot remember the detail of the conversation, and there isn't a note of it. The conversation lasted for quite a short period, I would think probably less than 15 minutes or about 15 minutes. It was discussed, but exactly what was said, I cannot recall.
But given it was such a significant piece of information, surely you would have shown it to Mr. Murdoch.
Well, not necessarily.
The Conservative, Louise Mensch, was determined to press home the point. James Murdoch, she said, must have known the problem of hacking was more widespread.
Did James Murdoch say at any point during the meeting, clearly this has been more widespread, we must do something about it, or clearly this is more widespread? In other words, did he acknowledge himself in his comments to you during the meeting that hacking had been more widespread than Clive Goodman? I'm asking you, if he could say that he did not understand what you were trying to tell him.
He, since he gave us the authority we were asking for in the context of what we'd said to him, I would take it that he understood.
Well, he gave you authority to settle the case.
For the first time, he realised the News of the World was involved, and that involvement involved people beyond Clive Goodman.
In a statement this afternoon, James Murdoch has insisted that he stands by what he's already told the committee. But MPs on the committee were also incredulous at the company's treatment of Clive Goodman, the paper's royal editor, who'd been convicted of a criminal offence. He'd been paid nearly £250,000, way beyond what he could have got from an employment tribunal if he'd been successful. The committee's Philip Davis addressed the point to the former head of employment law at News International, John Chapman.
You two took the decision, according to James Murdoch, you two took the decision not to defend yourselves at a tribunal, but to pay off Clive Goodman, not to the tune of £60,000, but to the tune of £140,000 plus £13,000 of costs. Now, if you'd made the right decision and there was absolutely no basis for Clive Goodman's allegations, what on earth were you doing paying him a further £140,000 on top of the £90,000 he'd already been given as a year's salary? How on earth could you justify that?
May I answer that, Mr. Davis?
Please do.
We didn't take the decision. The decision was taken by Mr. Hinton that it should be settled. Following our work on it and recommendation, having been told to try to get a reasonable settlement figure.
Les Hinton was executive chairman of News International at the time. So why, in John Chapman's view, had they decided to pay Clive Goodman so much?
At the tribunal proceedings, Mr. Goodman would have been able to make a number of allegations which we didn't believe, having done our exercise, had any foundation, but he would have been able to make those allegations in a public forum. There was a this is a pragmatic and commercial business decision, to my mind.
At the time, Clive Goodman had written to the company complaining about his dismissal, saying that hacking had been rife on the paper and even discussed at editorial meetings. An initial offer of £90,000, a year's salary, had not stopped him from threatening a tribunal. Labour's Jim Sheridan smelt a rat.
In a past life, I had the misfortune to represent people at industrial tribunals. And I must say I'd been delighted to go to the tribunal chaired by your good selves. And if I for any moment had went into that tribunal and said, not only do I want 12 months pay for this convicted criminal, but I want an additional payment on top of it, I'd be told to go away and sober up. That's just incredible.
It's also emerged that the editor in charge at the time Clive Goodman was hacking phones wanted the royal editor to get his job back. Andy Coulson, later to be David Cameron's director of communications, made it clear to Tom Crone.
Mr. Coulson had conversations with me on at least two or three occasions, where he said, you know, at the end of it all, when Clive had, if Clive was guilty and sentenced, when he had served his sentence, paid his fine, done his community service, served his prison sentence, whatever it was, he, Mr. Coulson, was hoping that he could persuade the company that Clive Goodman could come back and work for the company.
Throughout the hearing, MPs pressed witnesses on why the company had apparently been prepared to pay so much money to keep things out of court or tribunals. Labour's Tom Watson, who's made phone hacking practically his life, put it to Mr. Crone that the whole aim when dealing with Clive Goodman, Gordon Taylor and the private investigator Glenn Mulcair had been to keep things quiet.
You promised him his job in order to suppress evidence of criminality at News of the World.
That is not true.
And that's why James Murdoch agreed to pay the Taylor settlement, wasn't it?
That is not true.
It's for the same reason that you sanctioned the payment of Glenn Mulcair's legal fees, wasn't it?
I don't know whether I did sanction it.
The moment the phone hacking scandal, of course, went into the political stratosphere was when it emerged that the murdered schoolgirl Millie Dowler had had her phone hacked by the News of the World. Again, editors and senior managers insisted they didn't know it was happening. But the Tory MP Louise Mensch said that such stories obtained from Millie's phone messages had been spiked in later editions on one particular occasion. And she believes the lawyers must have known that was happening, something Tom Crone denied.
That is literally not credible, that you do not remember whether you did or you did not spike a story about voicemails on her phone on Saturday the 13th of August 2002.
Well, since I can't remember it, I don't think I did, to be perfectly honest. But I am very well aware of how serious this is. I am not trying to underplay it. It is hugely serious, and it's quite disgusting if what is published there came about as a result of illegal accessing. And I feel quite strongly about that, but I have no recollection of advising on that story.
If it was not you, Mr. Crone, it would have been a lawyer at the News of the World who
not
would have advised pulling it.
Absolutely not.
Who else might it have been?
Now, Carolyn, the committee will meet next Tuesday to discuss whether or not to recall James Murdoch and put these contradictions to him. We look like we're going down a bit of a blind alley, though, because there are no written records of this particular meeting in 2008 where it's claimed that James Murdoch was told about the widespread nature of phone hacking. So it's two men's word against one man's word. For those facing criminal investigation, though, this saga is far from over.
Gary O'Donoghue at Westminster, thank you very much, and we'll be bringing you more on this story later in the programme. For the moment, though, let's have a summary with Annie.
James Murdoch has said he didn't lie to MPs when he told them he hadn't known about an email which suggested phone hacking at the News of the World was more widespread than previously acknowledged. Two former executives told the Media Select Committee today that Mr. Murdoch was aware of the email. The government is lifting the ban on cameras in courts in England and Wales to allow the televising of judgments in the Court of Appeal. Turkey has suspended all military and trade ties with Israel because of Israel's refusal to offer a full apology for its killing of 9 Turkish activists heading for Gaza last year.
Annie, thanks very much. Well, the Labour MP, Chris Bryant, believes his phone was hacked. He was listening intently to that session. We brought you the summary there earlier. And Mr. Bryant, you maintain there's been a sustained cover-up at News International. What do you think we learn from today's committee session?
Well, we learned that there has been a cover-up, basically because the James Murdoch, when he appeared at the Select Committee, he asserted that the only reason they'd paid £700,000 to Gordon Taylor was because that's what their lawyers had advised them. But we now know that they were advised that precisely because there was clear evidence that would now come into the public domain if they didn't go ahead with that, if they didn't pay him off, that it wasn't just one rogue reporter, namely Clive Goodman, at the News of the World that was involved in the phone hacking scandal, but that it was much wider than that. So I'm afraid that today James Murdoch's evidence is completely blown apart.
Well, he, as you know, is insisting again today that he stands by the evidence he gave to the committee. He maintains he wasn't told about that email. Given that contradiction then between what he says and what his former employees say, do you think he has to be recalled?
I'm sure he'll be recalled. It will be inconceivable that he shouldn't be recalled. But, I mean, I just asked the question, I rather pose the proposition, he would say that, wouldn't he? What I can't understand is why his staff would say something different unless they were actually telling the truth, and I believe they are now telling the truth, that there are problems for them as well, because some of the evidence that they gave today contradicts evidence that has been given previously. And I'd merely point out, I've been trying to do a list of all the lies that thus far have been told to parliamentary inquiries during this whole process, and it's well into the 50s and 60s, and at some point somebody's going to have to answer for all those lies.
And these evidence sessions are not under oath, but another inquiry starting under Lord Justice Leveson into the relationship between the press and the public, the police and politicians will be. Will that make a difference?
Absolutely. I think that evidence given to select committees should be on oath so that if somebody tells lies, they can be done for perjury, as happens in many other countries in the world, most notably in the United States of America. Now, committees have that opportunity sometimes, but it's very... I'm not aware of an instance when that's been used. I think that we should make that standard, because if we're going to, as parliamentarians, do our real job, which is hold the power of the land, namely the government, to account, but also the other powers in the land, like the big broadcasters or Tesco's or BP or whoever else, then we need to be absolutely certain that the evidence that is being given to us is true and is not just a partial version of the truth, but is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. James Murdoch clearly didn't give us the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
You are among a number of people who are applying to participate in the inquiry by Lord Justice Leveson. You want to be a core participant, we're told. What does that mean?
I was hoping you might be able to tell me. The point is that a large number of people, including newspapers, want to be able to take part because we want to inform the whole process of the inquiry so that we get to the bottom of what really went on, probably not just at the News of the World, but certainly at the News of the World and across the whole of the industry, so that we can perhaps help the investigative journalism, which is such an important part of British democracy, returned to its old tradition of being about bringing the truth to light with decency, with courage, and within the law.
Now, the judge says that his inquiry will look into the culture, practice and ethics of the press, and then later will consider the extent of any improper in contact. He says he wants to produce a report within a year, but clearly he'll need to get a move on. I wonder whether you've heard yet whether you will be called.
No, I think he said that in the next couple of days he's going to be deciding. If you're a core participant, you have legal support, as I understand it, from the inquiry as well. But there are other elements. I would just say to anybody who's listening to this story, Shakespeare wrote 5-act plays. I think we're only in act 3 of this because we've still got the police investigations to be completed. I suspect that there will be a large number of charges brought against a significant number of people. I may be proved wrong, but I don't think I will be from some of the stuff that we've already seen. I think Parliament will want to get to the bottom of whether it was lied to, and if so, what it's going to do about that, whether it means that it will bring people to the bar of the House to arraign them, as we used to do in the 19th century, and for that matter in 1951. And I think think there are still the court cases, and let's never forget that it was Sienna Miller and others bringing court cases against News of the World that brought to light the failure of the Metropolitan Police to do the proper investigation in the first place, which could have happened in 2007.
This continues. Chris Bryant, Labour MP, thanks very much.